Good day, this is Kindergarten Cop, and today I will be reading from the Decatur Herald and Review. Starting off this morning with an article titled Jazzed About Decatur Roots, MacArthur Grad Violinist Lauded in Poland Music Competition by Valerie Wells. Gustavo Cabrera's music career began in the MacArthur High School Jazz Band. It's not necessarily that I was thinking of a music career, Cabrera said. I honestly had no idea what else to do, and I could not for the life of me really do anything else very well anyway. It was a bit terrifying as the end of high school came closer and closer, since my prospects for anything else wasn't too promising. When I joined the jazz band under Mr. C., Jim Culbertson, who led the renowned jazz band, I felt like I was surrounded by an environment that was giving me a lot. I might not have realized it at the moment, but for any aspiring musician indicator, that was the place to be. We learned to be a part of something that reached such a high level that it only made us all want to improve what we had. Now living in Rotterdam, the Netherlands, Cabrera recently came in third in the Seifert competition, the world's only international jazz competition for string instruments. The competition is held in Krakow, Poland, where Zbigniew Seifert was born. Seifert was one of the most outstanding jazz violinists in the history of the instrument. In the 1970s, Seifert revolutionized the role of the violin in jazz, creating his own musical language that combined the freedom of improvisation with the virtuosity of classical technique. That spirit is what the competition is built on, and the jury is made up of renowned musicians in the international and jazz scenes. Cabrera began playing violin at the age of 5 in elementary school and took saxophone lessons from Perry Rask, who, quote, drilled jazz techniques into him, he said. The bright side, where good news lives. He is a big part of the reason jazz was strongly to this day in my life, Cabrera said. Most of what I learned on the saxophone, I later realized while in Argentina that I could apply it to my violin when some musicians asked me to take it. It was rare to see a jazz violin in a performing group over there, so I tried it out and I tried to keep at it. Most violin competitions are focused on classical music, but for the Seifert competition, jazz and improvisation are the focus, and Cabrera had to compose his own music for it. A band is provided to accompany the competitors, and there was very little time to rehearse, he said. He entered the competition after being encouraged by other violinists he met. One night, playing at a club in Lisbon, I met a few violinists that had just competed in Poland and told me about it, Cabrera said. They said I should definitely try, that I would do well there. At the time, I didn't have a jazz group of my own, as most competitors do, so I thought if it was something I would do, it would have to be sometime in the future, at least before the competition's age limit gets me. Finally, I knew this was a year, would be the year to try, and since last year it's been on my mind, and just getting through the application round was a big deal. After graduating MacArthur, Cabrera studied violin and saxophone at Millikan University before transferring to Codarts University for the Arts in the Netherlands, where he earned bachelor's and master's degrees in music competition. He moved to Argentina, quote, for love, and played in symphony orchestras in Buenos Aires. When the love didn't work out, he moved to Europe for the music scene and eventually did find a love that worked out, he said. For the future, he said, he's fulfilled most of his ambitions. His father, Eduardo, a Millikan professor who won an award in 2018 for Best Latino-Focused Book of the Year for 9 Cuentos de Inmigrantes en los Estados Unidos, 9 Stories of Immigrants in the United States, is naturally proud of his son's success. Michael Luxner, former director of Decatur Millikan University Orchestra, told me, "When I have an emergency and need a violinist, I can call Gustavo, knowing that he can play without the need of participating in the rehearsals," Eduardo Cabrera said. Why People Are Surprised About Gustavo's Talent, not only because he can play jazz, tango, and classical music, and in Texas he also played Mexican music in a mariachi band, but also because he is as good playing violin as saxophone. As a father, I am also surprised of the numerous awards he got as violinist and saxophonist. The elder Cabrera thinks the family's multicultural background had a great influence on his son. Gustavo Cabrera has citizenship in the United States, Argentina, and the Netherlands, with his father a native of Argentina and his mother Liz from El Salvador. The family has lived in four states, and Gustavo was born in California. Sometimes, as Gustavo's father, I am asked to describe his musical style, Eduardo Cabrera said. For me, that is impossible to do, because I always find his music so complex and the fact that he is nurtured on so many different genres and styles. Champaign County hosts Dark Sky Sight by Julia Levy. When the sun is out at Middle Fork River Forest Preserve in Champaign County, visitors will find themselves surrounded by 1,700 acres of scattered ponds for fishing, a labyrinth of trails for exploring, and picnic tables among the groves. But when dusk arrives and the moon rises, that's when visitors are surrounded by stars, and it's time to look up. Middle Fork River Forest Preserve is Illinois' first and only international dark sky place. To achieve such a certification from Dark Sky International, a site must have a visual band zenith luminance of 21.2 magnitudes per square arc second. In simple terms, this means that the Milky Way must be visible almost every clear night. Middle Fork River Forest Preserve outshines those requirements. Some of the deepest night sky objects can be seen on the preserve's Dark Sky Trail, with a half-mile galaxy loop in the middle of an open field. In recent years, the state has taken action aimed at addressing light pollution. Beginning in 2025, the state's Responsible Outdoor Lighting Control Act began prohibiting outdoor lighting purchased with state funds from exceeding certain brightness thresholds. The General Assembly sent another bill to Governor J.B. Pritzker this year on the subject as well. I took the dark skies for granted because I lived on a rural farm, Matt Kuntz, longtime Illinois resident and site superintendent of the preserve, said in an interview. In 2018, I realized we needed to take up the effort to make this location a dark sky park, and that's when it all started. Kuntz, alongside his staff and astronomers throughout the state, undertook the effort to receive such a designation and were successful that year. It's what came next that surprised Kuntz. The Dark Sky Place title has brought awareness beyond what Kuntz previously imagined. For instance, the preserve greeted hundreds of visitors during this year's International Dark Sky Week in April. Kuntz and his team hold 3 to 5 educational stargazing events a year, which he said are almost always oversubscribed. Kuntz also has been invited to astronomy conferences across the country. In one notable instance, he said he spoke at a national conference in Tucson that was so full the organizers needed to get more chairs. Kuntz said he is as surprised as he is humbled by the newfound attention. The guests and campers we have from all 50 states shows why we converse in dark skies. Folks come to Central Illinois for dark skies, Kuntz said. For University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign exchange student Dominique Farfan, the preserve's impact reaches internationally. When her brother, Martin Farfan, arrived from Italy, the first thing on the list was to go to Middle Fork River Forest Preserve's International Dark Sky Park. They weren't disappointed. The sky was aglow with the Milky Way, stars, and a waxing gibbous moon when they visited this spring. It feels, I don't know, like surreal, Dominique Farfan said. I've never seen the sky so clear before. Senate Bill 3037 was passed in May to amend the state's Energy Efficiency and Control Act that allows municipalities to adopt, quote, stretch energy codes that are more stringent than the Illinois Energy Conservation Code. It is awaiting the governor's signature. The bill states that by December 2029, the Illinois Capital Development Board will create a stretch energy code regulating outdoor lighting for public and private entities in the municipalities where it is adopted. The code would create several listed lighting requirements in an effort to reduce light pollution. By addressing excessive and misdirected artificial light at night, the bill aims to improve public health, protect ecosystems, enhance nighttime visibility, and reduce unnecessary energy use, State Senator Laura Ellman, Democrat of Naperville, who introduced the bill, said in a statement. Exploring the night sky can be done in many rural areas in the state. In early June, Jupiter and Venus appeared very close in the sky in the west just after sunset in an astronomical event called a conjunction. Being able to go to a site with clear sky visibility allows for something much greater for Dominique Farfan's brother. When you go to the city, work, study, you don't have the time to go outside. I think it's one of the things I miss the most from when I was younger, to allow me to see the stars, Martine Farfan said. This article is accompanied by a photo of siblings Dominique and Martine Farfan choosing to spend their visit in Illinois stargazing at the state's only international dark sky park in Champaign County. And the photo is from Julia Levy of Medill, Illinois News Bureau. Turning to public safety, attempted murder alleged in brick attack by Dunnett Beckett. One man has been charged with attempted murder after police say he struck another man in the head with a brick, causing life-threatening injuries. According to a sworn affidavit filed in Macon County Circuit Court, Decatur police officers were dispatched at approximately 7:43 a.m. Tuesday to 151 South Main Street in reference to a battery. The officers located the 49-year-old victim who said he was in an alley when he was hit with a brick. He told police a man, later identified as Roy M. Whitelow, Jr., 37, of Decatur, was upset the victim wouldn't speak to him, according to the affidavit. The victim told officers that Whitelow approached him as if he wanted to fight, according to the affidavit. The victim said he retrieved and opened two folding pocket knives from his waistband, but continued to walk away while also attempting to pick up a stick. The victim said Whitelow picked up a brick from the alleyway and threw it, hitting him on the left side of his head. Officers found the victim with a 3-inch bleeding laceration on the left side of his head and above his ear. A red broken brick with jagged edges was found nearby. The victim was taken to a local hospital, then transported to a Springfield hospital for treatment of a fractured skull and a brain bleed. Whitelow was later located in the 200th block of West William Street. He said the victim didn't like him and began to make racist statements towards him, the affidavit said, dated. Whitelow wasn't able to repeat the racist statements. After he saw the two knives and the victim advanced towards him, Whitelow told police he picked up the brick to defend himself. The affidavit said security video supported the victim's description of the events, as did information provided by multiple witnesses. Whitelow is charged in Macon County Circuit Court with attempted murder and 3 counts of aggravated battery. During a detention hearing Wednesday, it was determined Whitelow will remain in the Macon County Jail. He was appointed a public defender. The case is set for a preliminary hearing on August 5th. Crews called to fire in ADM East Plant by Dunnett Beckett. A cause quote, smoldering incident Wednesday at the Decatur Archer Daniels Midland Company is under investigation, the company said. At approximately 3:15 p.m. on Wednesday afternoon, employees were evacuated from the isolates area of the East Plant at ADM's processing complex in Decatur as a precaution due to a smoldering incident, ADM spokesman Dane Lisser said. Emergency protocols were followed to promptly contain and control the smolder. We are investigating the cause of the incident, he said. No injuries were reported. A news release issued by Decatur Fire Chief Neil Elder said firefighters arrived on scene to find the fire was contained within a processing vessel. ADM personnel had already taken action to contain the incident and requested assistance from the Decatur Fire Department to fully extinguish the remaining fire, the news release stated. A unified command was immediately established between ADM and the Decatur Fire Department, allowing both organizations to coordinate their response and safely bring the incident under control. Child HIV treatment down after USAID cuts. Global numbers fell 14%. Around 77,000 fewer children worldwide received HIV treatment supported by the U.S. in the year to October 2025 than in the previous fiscal year, according to a study that found declines after the Trump administration's cuts and changes to foreign aid. The study refers only to U.S.-supported care, and some of the children may have received treatment through national governments or other donors. The analysis of U.S. government data found U.S.-supported pediatric HIV treatment fell by around 14% year-on-year, although the researchers said more detailed country-level data were needed to assess the full impact. These are signals, not a verdict, but children cannot wait, said Kenneth Nagur, professor of global health at Jomo Kenyatta University of Agriculture and Technology and a co-author of the study presented at the AIDS 2026 conference in Rio de Janeiro on Tuesday. Other studies included by UNAIDS have also shown gaps in the HIV response since the cuts. The U.S. State Department said it had not reviewed the study in detail, but that its methodology was flawed. They said the decline was a sign of the success of the program, as fewer children were getting infected with HIV, and the numbers on treatment had been going down for 4 years. But the authors said the declines last year were steeper than this historical trend in 5 countries, Uganda, Haiti, Zambia, South Africa, and Kenya. To reach their conclusions, the team analyzed data provided by the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, the International U.S. HIV Program. They found a decline in U.S.-supported pediatric treatment in 20 of 21 countries analyzed. Other agencies and national governments may have stepped in to keep children on treatment, a stated aim of the U.S., and the decline in coverage is also slightly lower if, quote, central support or U.S. funding for national or subnational level work, rather than at clinics, is included. Around 55,000 fewer children were reached last year under that metric. The countries were chosen because they all had more than 2,000 children receiving PEPFAR-supported HIV treatment, the team said. The Cube brings game show glitz. British TV show comes to Chicago's Michigan Avenue by Ryan P.C. Trimble. Flashing lights, LED screen floors, 60 seconds to complete a challenge, all this in a large transparent cube, its sliding door almost, but not quite, dimming the roar of the crowd outside. If that sounds like the description of a television game show, that's because it is. The Cube was a long-running British show that was briefly adapted for a U.S. run on TBS. But as of this July, it also describes a new attraction to join the resurgent Magnificent Mile corridor of Michigan Avenue. The Cube, newly opened at the corner of Michigan and Ontario, has a nearly hidden entrance adjoining Marshall's. Inside, it's a flashing electric game show fever dream, an in-person combination of Minute to Win It and Big Brother to play with friends. The Cube, the experience, began its life as The Cube, the television show. The rules of the British program are simple. Contestants must complete many games within an allotted time span. But like any good game show, there is a twist. Contestants play the deceptively simple games within the confines of a large, clear plastic cube. Gameplay begins when the LED screen floor flashes red. This new in-person cube has taken up residence in a former TJ Maxx, fitted out to suggest all the hallmarks of the television program. Here, there is not just one cube, but many spread across the floor and joined by bars and tables, a sleek, shining indoor carnival. The atmosphere is thanks to Cube director and creator Edward Mellors. "I'm a showman," he told the Tribune at an opening event Thursday night. "I was born into a carnival family." His family runs the UK-based Mellors Group, an entertainment company that operates carnivals, amusement parks, and fairs. The company traces its roots back more than 100 years to Mellors' great-grandfather, who ran a shooting gallery and a swing boat ride in the 1890s. Mellors grew up watching The Cube on television, and he knew it would be worth adding to the company's slate of projects, tapping into the competitive socializing trend which had taken root in the UK. The Cube currently has locations in London and Manchester. Now, Cube has come to Chicago, which Mellors said won over other American cities due to its connection to the television show. The American version of The Cube on TBS was hosted by Chicago's own Dwayne Wade, who contributed to the conversation when Mellors was searching for a U.S. location. Once Chicago was chosen, Mellors said finding the address was not difficult. Michigan Avenue is the equivalent of Oxford Street in London, he said, so it didn't take an awful lot of convincing that it was the right location. The Cube is the latest venture to add to Michigan Avenue's revival, in which the draw is less retail sales, more experiences. Attractions like the Hand and the Eye Magic Venue, new investment in the Looking Glass Theater, the Museum of Ice Cream, outdoor sculpture exhibits, and stores like the Harry Potter Shop and the Starbucks Reserve Roastery offer more than just shopping. Mellors said that venues must be able to offer in-person experiences to get people out of the house. That goes for The Cube. "I want to create a live TV game show," he said, "and you're in it. You're living it." A typical Cube experience involves playing 7 of the 21 mini games available across the 25,000 square foot space. After downloading an app and registering members of your team, which must be an even number of players, the computer randomly assigns your run of games for the evening. The games themselves, with names like Dual Aperture and Formation and Drop, are simple on the surface, and most of them involving moving a ball or series of balls from one receptacle into another, though sometimes memory comes into play. Tickets cost $52.50 and up. Host Peter Ruiz, who guides guests through their Cube experience, said that the company has the rights to all of the games from the television show, so games could be swapped out at any time. The Cubes are built to the same scale and specs as the television soundstage version as well. He added that hosts can customize gameplay to accommodate guests' needs, so no one will feel like they're assigned a game they physically cannot do. Beyond standard play, which is also the Cube Royale, at the sound of an air raid siren, which Mellors said he chose without realizing how much it sounded like a tornado siren, one game is chosen at random and its players compete for real-world prizes like cash and vacation packages. At the opening on Thursday, guest Tony Hopkins said the Cube differed from other establishments where you just sit down and talk. I feel like this kind of gets your body moving, she said, adding that people, quote, like to make an event out of hanging out. The Cube is not a pop-up. It was built as a permanent attraction that Mellers hopes will become a staple of Chicago. He's next planning to add cameras with the goal of turning visits into live stream ready events. He wants to pit international locations against each other in live competitions and hopes to expand elsewhere in the U.S. And when that happens, he says, Chicago will be raising a flag on this, going, we had it first. This article is accompanied by a photo of Avery Sebastian, who plays Invert at the Cube on July 16th in Chicago. The ticketed venue features 21 clear tubes with challenges inspired by the TV game show. Turning to government and politics, Soy City Indivisible to hold meeting on data centers by Valerie Wells. Soy City Indivisible will hold a meeting 6 to 7 p.m. Wednesday, July 29th in the Madden Auditorium at Decatur Public Library to discuss data centers and their impact on the electrical grid and water resources. The event is free and open to the public, though registration is encouraged. The event also will be live streamed on Soy City Indivisible's Facebook page and YouTube channel. The agenda includes a brief overview of the data center landscape in Illinois and Macon County, including the latest developments and news, insights into potential impacts on water, energy, and the environment, relational information pertaining to the Broadwing Energy Center, and a Q&A session with presenters. The event is sponsored by Soy City Indivisible, Prairie Rivers Network, Citizens Utility Board, and Illinois People's Action. And this article is accompanied by a photo of members of the Soy City Indivisible who are protesting at the corner of Franklin and El Dorado Streets on Saturday against the overnight invasion of Venezuela and arrest of the country's president, along with his wife. The photo is taken by Valerie Wells of the Herald and Review. Drive for First Clean Audit reveals flaws. From too many zeros to too few, and even the letter O typed in its place, a new systems at the Pentagon have uncovered a trail of mistakes as the Defense Department pursues its first clean audit. After years of work, the Pentagon is on track to pass its first ever financial audit in 2028. The U.S. Army's top financial officer told Reuters, a breakthrough for an agency that manages nearly $1 trillion a year, but has never been able to fully account for its spending. Since 2018, the Pentagon has undergone annual audits assessing how it tracks weapons, property, and personnel across its global operations. The audit was congressionally mandated in a bill passed in 1990, but department-wide audits began in 2018 after delays and reprieves. Repeated failures have revealed gaps in the department's financial systems, making it difficult to trace government funds from the time they are allocated until they are spent. After failing its eighth consecutive audit in December, the acting Pentagon Chief Financial Officer, Jules Hurst, said at the time it was committed to resolving its critical issues and achieving an unmodified audit opinion by 2028. The task has been daunting. For example, the Army, which alongside the Navy and Air Force makes up the bulk of the U.S. military, operated more than 1,300 separate business systems in 2019, a number that has since been cut to about 200. New technology to view all Army spending at once came online in June, leading to several breakthroughs. We're on track, and we feel confident that we'll be part of the overall opinion issued for the department in 28, said Mark Anderson, the Army's comptroller, referring to passing a consolidated Pentagon-wide audit in 2028.